Chapter 70. Something had to break for us. At 7 in the morning, I sat alone at a table outside the Café du Monde, across from Jackson Square. I ate sugar-dusted beignets and sipped chicory-laced coffee. I stared off in the direction of the spires of Saint-Louis Cathedral and listened to the bleating horns of riverboats coming down the Mississippi. It should have been a nice time in the morning, except that I was frustrated and angry and filled with energy that I didn't know what to do with. I had seen a lot of bad cases, but this was possibly the most difficult to comprehend. The gruesome murders had been going on for more than 11 years, but the pattern was still unclear, and so was the motivation of the killers. As soon as I reached the FBI offices, I got the disturbing news that a 15-year-old girl was missing, and that she lived less than 6 blocks from the magicians. It was possible that she was a runaway, but it didn't seem likely to me. Still, she had been gone less than 24 hours. There was a briefing scheduled, and I went upstairs to find out more, and also why I hadn't been alerted earlier. When I entered the session that morning, I sensed the frustration everywhere I looked. It was hard to imagine a worse result. We suspected that we had tracked down the murderers, but there was nothing we could do about it. And now, possibly, they had murdered another victim right under our noses. I sat down beside Jamila. Both of us had containers of hot coffee, plus the morning edition of the Times-Picayune. There was nothing about the missing girl. Apparently, the New Orleans police had sat on the disappearance until early that morning. Kyle was as angry as I'd ever seen him. He just wasn't himself. He was storming about the front of the room, his right hand nervously combing back through his dark hair. I didn't blame him. Everything about the investigation depended on cooperation between the local police and the FBI. The NOPD had broken that trust, broken it badly. "For once I sympathize with Mr. Craig," Jamila said. "The locals were way out of line." "We could have been working on the girl's disappearance for hours," I agreed. "What a mess. And it's getting worse."
"Well, maybe that's our opportunity. I wonder if we could get inside the house during the party tonight. What do you think? I'd love to give it a try," she whispered. "Everybody who comes to the so-called fetish ball will be in costume, right? Presumably. Somebody needs to get inside that house. We need to do something."
Kyle stared directly at Jamila and me. He raised his voice. "Can we have one meeting?"
"He means, can he have his meeting?" she whispered.
I wondered why she had taken such a dislike to Kyle. He was acting strange, though. The pressure of the case was getting to him. Something had him on edge. "And tell him what you think," I said. "He'll listen, especially now that the girl is missing."
"I doubt it. But what can he do? Fire me?"
She swiveled around to face Kyle.
"I think we could probably get inside the house tonight during the party. And if we don't, what do we lose? The missing girl might be in there."
Kyle hesitated, but then he said, "Do it. Let's see what's in the house." Chapter 71. It could only happen like this in New Orleans. I spent part of the afternoon securing a couple of printed invitations, and then Jamila and I prepared our costumes for that night. The ball began at midnight, but we'd heard that most of the crowd wouldn't start to arrive until closer to 2. It had already been a long night for us by the time the festivities started. We waited until just past 2 to approach the house. Some of the partygoers were college age, a few were even younger, but at least half of the crowd looked to be 30 or older. A few arrived in limousines and other expensive cars. The dress for the night was definitely eye-catching. Antique morning coats and top hats, velvet Victorian gowns, corsets, walking sticks, tiaras. The goth crowd sheathed their androgynous bodies mostly in black leather and velvet, with frilly white and black lace on several of the women. There were body piercings everywhere, belly rings, dog collars, black lipstick and gobs of mascara on both the men and the women. Blood-red eyes stared from every direction. It was difficult to look away from them. A song called Pistol Grip Pump played from hidden speakers outside the house. Fangs were everywhere, and stage blood. A few of the women wore black or purple velvet bands around their necks,
presumably to conceal bite marks. It got more interesting and eerie inside the house. People were addressing one another with titled names. Sir Nicholas, Mistress Anne, the Baroness, Prince William, Master Ormson. A statuesque woman walked by and brazenly sized up Jamila. She was bronzed with body paint and wore a bronze-colored thong. The iron scent of blood mingled with smoky leather and pungent oil from wall torches. Jamila looked ready. She was definitely tough. She had on a tight, sleek black dress with leather boots and black stockings. If she wanted to look sexy, she'd succeeded. She'd purchased black lipstick and leather wristbands at a place called the Little Shop of Fantasy on Dumain Street. She'd also helped me with my outfit. A morning coat that scraped the floor, cravat, black trousers, and black boots that came to my knees. No one seemed to pay much attention to the two of us. We checked out the main floor, then flowed with the crowd down into the basement. There were flaming torches everywhere on the stone walls. The floors were dirt and stone. It was cold and damp and musty. "Jesus, Alex," Jamila whispered close to my ear. She took my arm, held it tight. I don't think I would have believed it if I wasn't standing right here. I felt exactly the same. Many of those congregating downstairs wore canine teeth that were terrifying, especially in such large numbers. Electrified candelabras and fiery torches were the only sources of light. I saw human skulls nailed into the walls, and I was sure they were real. I started checking to make sure we could get out of there if we had to. I wasn't sure about a quick escape. The crowd was thickening, and the feeling was claustrophobic. I wondered if someone was supposed to die here tonight. If so, who? Then I heard a deep voice announce, "The Sire is here. Bow your heads." Chapter 72. The cavernous underground room was quiet and tense. I had the uncomfortable feeling that I was about to see something I wasn't supposed to. Then Daniel Erickson and Charles Defoe made their grand entrance. The magicians epitomized outrageous bohemian royalty. The audience of faithful obediently bowed their heads. Both men were physically impressive. Charles was bare-chested and wore skin-tight leather pants with boots. He was an erotic-looking man with a powerful build. Daniel had on a tight black frock coat with black trousers and a black silk cravat. He was well-muscled, but slender at the waist. Tugging against a heavy metal leash in front of them was a white Bengal tiger. Jamila and I exchanged looks. "This is getting interesting in a hurry," she whispered. Daniel stopped to talk with several of the young men. I remembered that the earliest murder victims were all men. The tiger was less than 10 feet away from me. What part did it play in this? Was it just a symbol? And for what? Charles came and stood next to Daniel against the far wall. He whispered something close to Daniel's face. They laughed and looked around the room. Daniel finally spoke in a loud, clear voice. I could tell he expected to be listened to. His confidence was charismatic. "I am the Sire. What a vibrant and alive gathering this is," he said. "I can feel the energy coursing through this room. It excites me. The force harnessed here knows no limits. Believe in it. Believe in yourselves. Tonight is a special night, so come with me to the next room, the next level. Come, if you believe. Or even better, if you don't." Chapter 73. I had never seen anything like this. Jamila and I were quiet and wide-eyed as we entered an even larger chamber in the basement. The room was lit by wall sconces, most of them electric. The brutal fangs gleamed everywhere. The white tiger had begun to growl, and I recalled the bites into human flesh. "If you hunt for vampires." What was happening in this eerie cellar? What was the purpose of tonight's gathering? Who were these ghouls? Hundreds of them. Daniel and Charles stood beside two tall, handsome men in satiny black robes. They looked to be in their early 20s, maybe even younger. They looked like young gods. Everyone crowded forward to see what would happen next. "I am here to anoint two new vampire princes," Daniel announced with grave authority. The persona was the same one he used on stage. "Bow before them." A woman in front screamed, "Our princes," she shrieked. "Dark princes, I worship you." "Silence," Charles shouted. "Take that stupid cow out of here. Banish her." The light suddenly blinked once, then went out completely. The few burning torches were doused. I reached for Jamila, and we slid back toward the nearest wall. I couldn't see anything. I felt a cold spot at the center of my chest. "What the hell is happening, Alex?" "I don't know. Let's keep together." It got crazy very fast in the darkness. People screamed. A whip cracked nearby. It was madness, chaos, sheer terror. Jamila and I had our guns out. There wasn't anything we could do in the dark. A minute or so passed. Everything was inky blackness. It seemed like a very long time, too long. I was afraid of being stabbed or bitten. A generator kicked in somewhere in the house. The lights in the cellar flickered, then went on again. Then off. Then on to stay. I saw after images, rings of color, and then the magicians had disappeared. Someone shouted, "There's been a murder! Oh God, they're both dead!" Chapter 74. I pushed my way through the shocked crowd and didn't meet resistance. Then I saw the bodies. The two young men in black robes lay sprawled on the cellar floor. They had been stabbed and their throats cut. Blood was pooled around the bodies. Where were Daniel and Charles? "Police," I called out. "Don't touch them. Back away." The men and women closest to the body slunk away. I wondered if they had been about to drink the spilled blood. Wasn't that the ritual? The pattern for the ghoulish murders so far?
"There's only two of them. Two cops," someone shouted.
"We will shoot you," Jamila called out in a loud, clear voice.
"Back away. Do it." "Where are Daniel and Charles?" I shouted. The crowd began to close in on us, so I fired off a warning shot. It echoed loudly. The shot created renewed chaos in the cellar. Men and women began struggling to get through the doors. No one was getting away, though. FBI agents were waiting outside. Jamila and I pushed our way into a connecting room in the basement. We started down a narrow hallway lit only by candles. Daniel and Charles could have come this way when the lights went out. It seemed likely. They knew the house. There were small rooms crowded next to one another on either side of the dusty tunnel. The layout reminded me of ancient catacombs. Everything was closed in, musty, damp, depressing as hell, scary. "You okay?" I glanced back at Jamila.
"I'm fine, so far anyway. This place is starting to grow on me," she wisecracked. Her eyes darted about, though.
I could hear Kyle's voice calling to us. The FBI was inside now. "Anything up there? Alex, you see anything?"
"Not yet. Daniel and Charles took off when the lights went out. No sign of them."
We moved cautiously, checking each of the rooms. Most of the space seemed to be used for storage. A few were completely empty, dank and eerie, like tombs. Atmospheric, I suppose. Spooky for sure. I kicked open another door. Jamila and I peered in. She gasped. Her mouth opened in a silent scream.
"Oh, Jesus! Alex, what the hell happened?"
I reached out and held onto her arm. I couldn't believe what I was looking at. I couldn't make myself believe it. My knees went weak. Daniel and Charles were laid out on the floor of the room. They had been murdered. I was too stunned to speak. Kyle came into the room behind us, said not a word. We moved closer to the bodies, but I knew they were dead. The throats of both men had been cut, and there were deep bites, fang marks. So who was the sire now?
Part 4.
Hunt.
Chapter 75. Late the following afternoon, Jamila had to return to San Francisco. She pretty much admitted that she was burned out and baffled. I gave her a ride to the airport, and we continued to talk about the murder case all the way there. We realized we were both obsessing. What had happened the night before changed everything. We had tracked down the supposed killers, and they had been killed. This was a complex and thoroughly annoying murder mess in which anything seemed possible. The killers weren't necessarily clever, but they were full of surprises.
"Where do you go from here, Alex?" she asked, as we turned into the airport.
I laughed. "Oh, now it's where do I go?"
"You know what I mean. Come on."
"I'll probably stay down here for another day or two, see if I can help out. Everyone who's in the house, at least the ones who were caught, are being held by the New Orleans police. That's a lot of freaks to be interviewed. Somebody has to know something. If you can get anything out of them."
"You think the New Orleans cops are cooperating now? They sure weren't before."
I smiled. "You know how stubborn local cops can be. We'll get what we need. It just might take a little longer. I'm sure that's part of the reason Kyle wants me to stay on." She frowned at the mention of Kyle's name. I knew she was disappointed to be leaving, though.
"I have to get back home, but I'm not going to drop this one. My friend Tim at the Examiner is doing another big piece on the California murders. Maybe it all started out there. Think about it."
11 years ago, maybe more," I said.
"But who were the first killers? Daniel Erickson and Charles Defoe? Someone else in the cult? Is there a cult?"
She threw her hands up in the air.
"I have no idea at this point. I'm practically brain dead. I'm going to get on my plane and sleep all the way home."
We talked some more about the weirdness of the case. Then I asked her about Tim at the Examiner.
"Just a friend," she said.
Jamila and I shook hands at the curbside luggage drop in front of the area marked for American Airlines. Then she leaned in and kissed me on the cheek. I slid my hand behind her neck and held her for a few seconds. It was nice. The two of us had shared a lot of pain and misery in a short time. We had also been in a life-threatening situation.
"Alex, as always, an honor," she said as she pulled away. "Thanks for the Krispy Kremes and everything else."
"Keep in touch," I said. "Will you, Jamila?"
"Absolutely, I plan to. You can count on it. I mean that, Alex."
Then Inspector Jamila Hughes turned away and walked inside the bustling terminal at New Orleans International. I was definitely going to miss her. I already thought of her as a friend. I watched her go, then headed back to the FBI offices in New Orleans to bury my head in some work. I went over everything we had with Kyle. Then we went over everything again, just to be sure it was as fucked up as we thought it was. The two of us agreed that there weren't even any good theories about what had happened to Daniel and Charles. We just didn't know. No one was talking so far. Or maybe no one had seen anything. Whoever killed them wanted to show us that they were superior. To them, to us, physically, mentally, in terms of their ruthlessness, I said. But I wasn't really sure about that. I was just thinking out loud. "I don't think it was an accident that the whole thing feels a little like a magic trick," Kyle said.
"Doesn't that strike you, Alex? Some connection to magic?"
"Yeah, but it wasn't a magic trick. Daniel and Charles are dead, and so are a lot of other people, going back a lot of years. We're nowhere, is that what you're saying?"
"Yeah, and I don't like it here," I said.
Chapter 76. I worked late that night in the FBI office. So what else was new? Around 9, I was feeling lonely and edgy, all messed up. I had called home, but nobody was there. That worried me a little, until I remembered that it was my Aunt Tia's birthday, and Nana was throwing a party at Tia's new house in Chapelgate, north of Baltimore. I hadn't bought Tia a present. Damn it. Damn me. Ever since I had come to Washington as a kid, Tia had never forgotten my birthday. Not once. This year, she had given me the watch that I was wearing now. I called her house in Maryland, and I got to talk to most of my relatives.
They teased that I was missing out on some great socket tume cake. They wanted to know where I was and when I was coming home. I didn't have a satisfactory answer to give them. Soon as I can. I miss you all. You have no idea how much I miss being there. I decided I needed to stop in at the magician's house before I went back to the Dauphine. Why did I need to do that? I wondered. Because I was wired. Because I am obsessive. A couple of New Orleans policemen were stationed out front. They looked bored and underutilized, and definitely not obsessive. I showed them ID, then I was let inside. No problem, Detective Cross. I really wasn't sure why, but I had a vague feeling that we had missed something in the house. Forensics had spent hours going over the place. So had I. We hadn't found anything concrete. Still, I didn't like being in the old house again. The domain. Maybe I needed a gree-gree for protection. I walked through the overdone, very ornate foyer and living room. My footsteps made the big house sound empty. I kept wondering, what were we missing? What was I missing? The master bedroom was situated off the hall at the top of the stairs. Nothing had changed since the first time I was in there. Why in hell had I bothered to come back? The large open room was filled with dark modern art. Some of it hung, but several paintings were propped up against the walls. The magician slept in a bed, not in the coffins we'd found below in the tunnels.
As I was searching through their closet again,
I came across something I hadn't seen before. I was sure it hadn't been there when I examined the bedroom earlier. Lying among the shoes were effigies of Daniel and Charles, miniature dolls of the magicians. There were slash marks across the throats, chests, and faces, just like the way they had been murdered. Where the hell had the gruesome effigies come from? What did they mean? What was going on down here in New Orleans? Who had gotten into this house after we sealed it? I was tempted to call Kyle, but I held off. I wasn't sure why. I didn't want to go back down into the tunnels alone and at night, but I was here, and I figured I ought to take another quick look around. There were two cops posted right outside the door, right? What were we missing? Unspeakably violent murders went back at least 11 years. Our two best suspects had been murdered. Someone had put effigies in their bedroom. I went down to the cellar, then into the tunnels that spidered out in several directions from the main area. New Orleans is about 8 feet below sea level, and the cellar and tunnels were probably always damp. The walls sweat. I heard a scraping noise and stopped. Something was walking around. I reached into my shoulder holster, took out my Glock. I listened closely. Nothing. Then more scraping. Mice or rats, I thought. Probably all it is. Probably. Almost definitely. I had to go and look further, though. That was my problem, wasn't it? I had to go look. Had to investigate. Couldn't just walk away. What was I trying to prove to myself? That I had no fears? That I wasn't like my father, who had quit on just about everything in life, including his kids and himself? I inched forward slowly and quietly, and I listened to the house. I could hear water dripping somewhere in the dank tunnels. I used my old Zippo to light a few torches hung on the tunnel walls. There were really bad images in my head. The bite wounds on the bodies I'd seen. The way Daniel and Charles had been attacked. The poisonous bites I'd suffered in Charlotte.
You're one of us now.
The anger, the rage connected to the murders were present in so many cities. What were the killers angry about? Where were they right now? I never heard them coming, never saw a movement. I was hit twice. The attackers had come swiftly out of the darkness. One went for my head and neck, the other hit around my knees. They were a team, efficient. I went down hard, and it took the wind right out of me. But I fell on the attacker who was wrapped around my legs. I heard a loud crack, maybe a bone breaking. Then a scream. He let me go. I got up, but the second assailant was attached to my back. He bit me. Oh, Jesus, no! I cursed and slammed him into the wall. I did it again.
Who the hell were these fantastic madmen? Who was the leech riding my back? He finally let go, the son of a bitch. I spun around at him. I clipped the side of his head with my gun. I hit him again with a solid left hook. He went down like a sack. I was breathing hard, still full of fight, though. Neither of the assailants was moving much now. I kept the gun on them while I lit another candle on the wall. That was better. Light always helps. I saw a male and female, probably no more than 16 or 17. Their eyes were like dark holes. The male must have been 6'6" or more. He had on a dingy white t-shirt with Marlboro Racing First to Finish printed on it, and baggy, scungy black jeans. The girl was around 5'2", with wide hips, wide everything. Her black hair was stringy and greasy, with reddish highlights. I touched my neck and was surprised that the skin wasn't broken. There was no blood on my hand. "You're under arrest," I yelled at the two of them. "You goddamn bloodsuckers."
Chapter 77. Vampires? If that's what these twisted creeps were. Assassins? Murderers? Their names were Ann Elo and John Jack Masterson, and they had attended Catholic high school in Baton Rouge until about 6 months ago, when they had dropped out and run away from home. Each was 17 years old. They were just kids. I spent 3 hours attempting to question the suspects that night, then another 4 hours the following morning. Elo and Masterson wouldn't talk to me or anyone else. Not a word. They wouldn't say what they were doing inside the mansion in the Garden District, why they had attacked me, whether or not they had placed the sinister effigies in the closet of the dead men. The teen simply glared across the plain wooden table in one or another of the interrogation rooms at police headquarters. The parents were notified and brought in, but Elo and Masterson wouldn't speak to them either. At one point, Ann Elo finally addressed her father with 2 words.
"Glow me."
I wondered how the cult of the vampires had satisfied her needs, her incredible anger. In the meantime, there were lots of others from the fetish ball to talk to. The commonality among most of them was that they held straight jobs in New Orleans. They were bartenders and waitresses, hotel desk clerks, computer analysts, actors, and even teachers. Most were afraid to have their alternative lifestyle come out at work, so they eventually talked to us. Unfortunately, no one told us anything revealing about Daniel and Charles or their murderers. It was an extraordinarily busy night at the precinct house. More than 2 dozen homicide detectives and FBI agents conducted re-interviews. We exchanged notes and bios with highlighted inconsistencies. We went hard at the most obvious liars in the group. We also kept a list of the witnesses who seemed most likely to break under pressure. We switched interviewers on them, sent them to their cells, then summoned them back before they could sleep. We doubled up on them. "All we need is a few rubber hoses," one of the New Orleans detectives said while we were waiting for Ann Elo to be fetched from her cell for the 6th time that night. His name was Mitchell Sams, and he was around 50, a black man, hugely overweight, tough, effective, cynical as hell. When Ann Elo was brought back into the interrogation room, she looked like a sleepwalker or a zombie. Her eye sockets were incredibly deep and dark. Her lips were chapped and caked with dried blood. Sams went at her.
"Good morning, Glory. It's nice to see your pasty white face again. You look like total shit, babe. I'm being kind. Several of your friends, including your pathetic boyfriend, have broken down already tonight."
The girl turned her vacant eyes toward a brick wall.
"You must be mistaking me for somebody who gives a shit," she said.
I decided to try an idea that had been weaving through my mind for the past hour or so. I had used it on a few of the others. "We know about the new sire," I told Ann Elo. "He's gone back to California. He isn't here for you. He can't help you or hurt you." Her face remained blank and unresponsive, but she folded her arms. She sagged a few inches in her chair. Her lips were bleeding again, possibly because she'd bitten into them.
"Who gives a shit? Not me."
Just then, a bleary-eyed NOPD detective hurried into the interrogation room where Mitchell Sams and I were working on Elo. The detective had dark sweat stains under both arms of his pale blue sport shirt. Heavy stubble covered his chin and cheeks. He looked about as exhausted as I felt.
"There's been another murder," he told Sams. "Another hanging murder."
Ann Elo slowly,
rhythmically clapped her hands.
That's great, she said.
Chapter 78. I drove to the crime scene alone, feeling increasingly more distant and unreal. The wheels in my head were turning slowly and methodically. Where did we go from here? I had no goddamn idea. Jesus, I was beat. The house was an outbuilding for one of the Garden District's historic homes, a small carriage house with a second-story balcony. It looked like it could have been a cute, cozy B&B. Magnolia and banana trees surrounded it on the outside. So did an intricate, wrought iron fence, the kind I had seen everywhere in the French Quarter. About half of the New Orleans Police Department was already at the scene. So were a couple of EMS trucks, their roof lights spinning and blazing. The press was beginning to arrive as we did, the late shift. Detective Sams had gotten to the murder scene a couple of minutes before I did. He met me in the hallway outside the upstairs bedroom where the killing had taken place. The interior of the place had fine detailing on almost every surface. Ceilings, banisters, moldings, doors. The owner had cared about the house and also about Mardi Gras. Feathers and beads, colorful masks and costumes were tacked up on most of the walls.
This is bad, even worse than we thought, Sam said. She's a detective named Maureen Cook. She's in Vice, but she was helping out on Daniel and Charles. Most of the department is pitching in.
Sam's led me into the detective's bedroom. It was small but attractive, with a sky blue ceiling. Someone had once told me that color was supposed to keep winged insects from nesting there. Maureen Cook was a redhead, tall and thin, probably in her early 30s. She had been hung by her bare feet from a chandelier. Her nails were painted red. The detective was naked except for a delicate silver bracelet on her wrist. Blood streaks were all over her body, but there was no sign of blood pooling on the floor or anywhere else. I walked up close to her. Sad, I whispered under my breath. A human life gone. Just like that. Another detective dead. I looked at Mitchell Sams. He was waiting for me to talk first. This might not have been done by the same killers, I said, and shook my head. The bite wounds look different to me. They're superficial. Something's changed. I stepped back from the body of Maureen Cook and took in her bedroom. There were photographs that I had recognized as part of E.J. Balak's study of Storyville prostitutes. Strange, but fitting for a vice detective. A couple of Asian fans had been framed over the bed, which looked as if it had been slept in, or possibly the bed hadn't been made the previous day. My cell phone rang. I hit a button with my thumb. I felt out of it. Numb. I needed sleep.
Did you find her yet, Dr. Cross? What do you think? Give me your best guess on how to stop these terrible murders. You must have figured it out by now.
The mastermind was on the line.
How did he know? Suddenly I was yelling into the phone. I'm going to take you down. I figured that much out, asshole.
I hung up on him. Then I shut the phone off. I looked around the bedroom. Kyle Craig was watching me from the doorway.
Are you all right, Alex? He whispered.
Chapter 79. When I got back to the Dauphine Hotel, it was 10:30 in the morning. I was too tired and too worked up to sleep. My heart was still racing. There was a message for me. Inspector Hughes had called from San Francisco. I stretched out on the bed and called Jamila back. I shut my eyes. I wanted to hear a friendly voice, especially hers.
I might have something good for you, she said when I reached her at home. In my spare time, ha-ha, I've been taking a close look at Santa Cruz. Why Santa Cruz, you might ask? There have been several unsolved disappearances there. Too many. I plotted them out myself. Alex, something is happening down there. It fits in with the rest of this case.
Santa Cruz was on our original list, I said. I was trying to focus on what she had just told me. I couldn't remember exactly where Santa Cruz was located.
You sound tired. Are you all right? She asked.
I just got back to the hotel a few minutes ago. Long night.
Alex, go to sleep. This can wait. Good night.
No, I can't sleep anyway. Tell me about Santa Cruz. I want to hear it.
All right. I talked to Lieutenant Conover with the Santa Cruz PD. Interesting conversation. Annoying, too. They're aware of the disappearances, of course,
They've also noted house pets and livestock disappearing in the past year. A lot of ranches in the area. Nobody believes in vampires, of course, but Santa Cruz has a certain reputation. The kiddies call it the vampire capital of the U.S. Occasionally, the kids are right.
I need to see what you have so far, I told her. I'm going to try to get a little sleep, but I want to read whatever Santa Cruz sends you. Can you send it to me?
My friend Tim at the Examiner promised to send me the relevant files. Meanwhile, today's my day off. I might just take a ride.
I opened my eyes wide. If you go, bring somebody along. Bring Tim, I mean it.
I told her about the murder of the vice detective Maureen Cook, here in New Orleans.
Don't go there alone. We still don't know what we're dealing with.
I'll take somebody along, she promised, but I didn't know if I could believe her.
Jamila, be careful. I don't have a good feeling about this.
You're just tired. Get some sleep. I'm a big girl.
We talked for a few more minutes, but I wasn't sure if I'd gotten through to her. Like most good homicide detectives, she was stubborn. I shut my eyes again and started to drift away. Then I was gone.
Chapter 80. Jamila was remembering a line from a favorite Shirley Jackson novel, The Haunting of Hill House, which had been made into a really disappointing movie. Whatever walked there, walked alone, Jackson had written. That pretty much summed up how she felt about the murder case, and maybe even about her life lately. She drove her trusty, dusty Saab toward Santa Cruz. She gripped the steering wheel a little too firmly most of the way, and her hands felt numb. The kink in her neck was getting worse. This was a disturbing case, and she just couldn't let it go. The killers were out there somewhere. They were going to keep murdering until somebody stopped them. So maybe she should stop them. She had tried to get her current boyfriend to go with her, but Tim was covering a bicyclist protest for the Examiner. Besides, she wasn't sure that she wanted to spend the whole day with him. Tim was sweet, but, well, he wasn't Alex Cross. So here she was getting off Route 1, entering Santa Cruz all by her lonesome. All by her damn lonesome again. At least she had alerted Tim that she was going to Santa Cruz, and of course she was a big girl, and armed to the teeth. Ugh, teeth, she thought. She cringed at the thought of fangs and the horrible deaths of all those who had been bitten. She had always liked Santa Cruz, though. Maybe because it was practically the epicenter of the Loma Prieta earthquake back in 89. 6.9 on the Richter scale, 63 dead. But then the area had come back. The gutsy little town and the people there had refused to fold. Lots of earthquake-proof construction, nothing higher than two stories. Santa Cruz was pure California, the best. As she drove, she watched a big blonde surfer climb out of a VW with a surfboard strapped to the roof. He was finishing off a drippy slice of pizza, heading into the bookshop Santa Cruz, pure California. There was quite a mix of people here. Post-hippies, high-tech startup folks, transients, surfers, college kids. She liked it an awful lot. So where were the goddamn vampires hiding? Were they here? Did they know she was here in Santa Cruz, looking for their gnarly asses? Were they among the surfers and post-hippies she was passing on the street? Her first stop was the town's police department. The lieutenant, Harry Conover, was totally surprised to see her in the flesh. She guessed he couldn't imagine any detective going out of his or her way on the job.
I told you I'd pass along everything I found on the goths and wannabe vamps. Didn't you believe me? He asked.
He shook his head of longish blonde curls, rolled his soft brown eyes. Conover was tall, well-built, probably in his mid-30s, around her age. Jamila could tell that he was a big flirt and that he had a high opinion of himself.
Sure, I believed you, but I had today off, and this case is burning a hole right through me, so here I am, Harry. Better than email, right? What do you have for me?
She sensed that he wanted to tell her to get a life, to enjoy her day off. She'd heard it all before, and maybe he was right. But not now, not with this case still on the boards.
I read in a couple of the reports that some of the local ghouls might be living together commune style. You have any idea where? She asked. Conover nodded and even pretended to be concerned. He was also checking her out, she could tell. Obviously, he was a breast man. We never got any confirmation of that, he said. Kids crashed together, of course, but I don't know about any commune. There are a couple of hot clubs, Catalyst, Palookaville, and lots of kids share cribs on Lower Pacific Street. She didn't give up, never. But if a lot of kids were living together, any ideas where that might be? Conover sighed and actually looked a little annoyed with her for asking. Jamila could tell he wasn't the kind of cop who put too much of himself into his work. She would have transferred him in a second if he worked for her, and Conover would have sworn it was a gender thing. It wasn't. He was a lazy, half-assed cop, and she hated that. Lives depended on how well he did his job. Didn't he understand that? Maybe out in the foothills or north around Boulder Creek, Conover finally volunteered in a soft drawl. I really don't know what to tell you. Of course you don't, Harry. Duh. Where would you look first? She persisted. If you were worth jack shit as a cop. Inspector, I just wouldn't be chasing this one too hard. Yes, there have been some curious disappearances around here, but that's true of just about every town up and down the coast of California. Kids are more restless now than they used to be when we were growing up. I don't believe anybody's getting seriously hurt in Santa Cruz, and I sure don't buy that this is the freaking vampire capital of the West Coast. It isn't. Believe me on that. There are no vampires in Santa Cruz. She nodded, pretended to agree. I think I'll try the foothills first, she said. Conover saluted her. If you're finished chasing ghouls before 7 or so, give me a call. Maybe we could have a drink. It is your day off, right? Jamila nodded. I'll do that. If I'm finished before 7, Harry. Thanks for all your help, jackass. Chapter 81. She was pissed now. Who in their right mind wouldn't be? Here she was, working her butt off in somebody else's town. She parked the Saab on a funky side street in town, near the Metro Center, right across from the Asti Bar. She had lost track of the San Lorenzo River while she was driving, but it was around here somewhere. She could smell it anyway. She had just gotten out of the car when two men appeared. They walked up quickly and flanked her tightly on either side. Jamila winced. They almost seemed to have appeared out of nowhere. Blonde ponytails, she thought. College kids? Surfers? She sure hoped so. They were well built, but they didn't look like weightlifters. More like they came by it naturally. Images of Eros, Hermes, and Apollo came to mind. Muscles that were extremely well-defined. Virility. Chiseled marble. Can I help you fellas out? She asked. Looking for the beach? The taller of the two spoke with tremendous confidence, or maybe it was cockiness. Doubt it, he said. We're not surfers, actually. Besides, we're from around here. How about you? Both of them had the deepest blue eyes. They were incredibly intense. One looked no older than 16. Their movements were deliberate and controlled. She didn't like this. There was no one else around to intervene on the side street. Maybe you could tell me where the beach is, she said. They were crowding her physically, standing too close. She wouldn't be able to get her gun out. She couldn't move without bumping into one or the other. They wore black t-shirts, jeans, rock climber shoes. You want to back off a little? She finally said. Just back off, okay? The older one smiled. The dent between his lip and nose was a sexy round hollow. I'm William. This is my brother, Michael. By any chance were you looking for us, Inspector Hughes? Oh, no. Oh, Jesus. Jamila tried to reach for her sidearm and the holster strapped to her back. They grabbed her, took away her gun as easily as if she were a child. She was astonished at how fast they moved and how strong they were. The two of them pushed her down on the sidewalk and handcuffed her. Where did they get cuffs? In New Orleans? The murdered detective? The older one spoke again. "Don't scream or I'll snap your neck, Inspector." He said it so matter-of-factly. "Snap your neck." The second one spoke then. He was right in her face. She saw the long canine fangs. "If you hunt for the vampire will hunt for you," he said. Chapter 82. She was gagged, then roughly thrown onto the rear seat of a pickup truck. The truck started up and took off with a jolt. Jamila tried to concentrate on everything about the trip. She counted off the seconds, kept track of the minutes. There was stop-and-go city driving, then faster, smoother riding, possibly on Route 1. Then a very bumpy road, possibly unpaved. She figured the trip took approximately 40 minutes. She was carried inside a building, some kind of ranch house or farm structure. People were laughing. At her? They wore fangs. Jesus. She was put down on a cot in a small room and her gag was removed. "You've come looking for the sire," the one who called himself William whispered, his face up close to hers. "You've made a terrible mistake, Inspector. This one will get you killed." He smiled horribly, and she felt as if she were being both ridiculed and at the same time seduced. The one called William touched her cheek with his long, slender fingers. He lightly caressed her throat, stared into her eyes. She was repulsed, wanted to run away, but couldn't do anything. There were a dozen or so vampires here, watching her like she was meat on a spit. "I don't know anything about a sire," she said. "What's a sire? Help me out here." The brothers looked at each other, shared a knowing smirk. A few of the others laughed out loud. "The sire is the one who leads," said William. He was so calm, so very sure of himself. "Who does the sire lead?" she asked. "Why, anyone who will follow," William answered. He laughed again, seemed to be enjoying himself immensely at her expense. "Vampires, Inspector. Others like Michael and myself. Many others in many, many cities. You can't imagine the extent of it. The sire stands firm with simple directions for what to think, how to act, things like that. The sire is not accountable to any authorities. The sire is a superior being. Are you starting to understand? Would you like to meet the sire?" "Is the sire here now?" she asked. "Where are we?" William continued to stare down at her. He was definitely seductive, disgusting. Then he leaned in closer. "You're the detective. Is the sire here? Where are you? You tell me." Jamila felt as if she might retch. She needed her space. "Why are we here?" she asked. She wanted to keep them talking, keep them occupied for as long as she could. William shrugged. "Oh, we've always been here. This used to be a commune. California dreaming hippies, mind-altering drugs, Joni Mitchell music. Our parents were hippies. We were isolated from other ways to live and think, so we depended on each other. My brother and I are unbelievably close. But we're nothing, really. We're here to serve the sire." "Was the sire always at the commune?" she asked. William shook his head and gave her a serious look. "There were always vampires here. They stayed apart, left the others alone. You had to join them, not the other way around." "How many are there?" William looked at Michael, shrugged his broad shoulders, and they both laughed. "Legions. We're everywhere." Suddenly, William roared and went for her throat. Jamila couldn't help it. She screamed. He stopped inches away from her, still growling like an animal. Then William purred gently. His long tongue licked her cheek, her lips, her eyelids. She couldn't believe what was happening. "We're gonna hang you and drink every last drop. The most amazing thing, you're gonna enjoy it when you die. It's ecstasy, Jamila."
Chapter 83. I had returned to Washington, and I was taking a much-needed day off. Why not? I hadn't seen enough of the kids lately, and it was Saturday after all. Damon, Janny, and I went to the Corcoran Gallery of Art that afternoon. The little creeps fiercely resisted the museum at first, But once they were inside the palace of gold and light, they were completely entranced. Then they didn't want to leave. Typical of them. When we eventually got home at around 4, Nana told me I was to call Tim Bradley at the San Francisco Examiner. Give me a break. This case wouldn't stop. Now I was supposed to call Jamila's buddy?
It's important that you call. That's the message, Nana said.
She was baking 2 cherry pies, reminding me how good it was to be home. It was 1 o'clock in California. I called Tim Bradley at his office. He picked up right away.
Bradley?
It's Detective Alex Cross.
Hi, I hoped you'd call. I'm a friend of Jamila Hughes.
I knew that much already. I interrupted. Is she okay?
Why do you ask that, Detective? She went to Santa Cruz yesterday. Did you know about that?
She mentioned she might go. Did somebody go with her? I asked. I suggested she bring company. His answer was curt and defensive. No.
Like Jamila always says, she's a big girl, and she carries a big gun.
I frowned and shook my head. So what's going on? Has something happened? Is something the matter?
No, not necessarily. She's usually careful, precise. I just haven't heard from her, and she promised to call. Last night. Now it's been another 4 hours since I called you. I'm a little concerned. It's probably nothing, but I thought you would know best about this particular case.
Does she do things like this often? I asked.
Investigate a case on her day off? Yes, that's jam. But she would definitely call me if she promised to.
I didn't want to upset him any more than he was, but I was worried now. I thought of my last 2 partners. Both had died, and neither of the murders had been solved. The mastermind claimed to have killed Betsy Cavalier, and also Detective Maureen Cook in New Orleans. So what about Inspector Jamila Hughes? I'm going to call the local police in Santa Cruz. She gave me a name and number. I think it was Conover. I have it written down in my notes. I'm going to call him right now.
All right. Thank you, Detective. Will you let me know?
Tim, the reporter, asked.
I'd appreciate it.
I said that I would, then tried to reach Lieutenant Conover at police headquarters in Santa Cruz. He wasn't working, but I made a fuss and dropped Kyle Craig's name. The sergeant reluctantly gave me Conover's home number. Someone picked up at the number, and I heard loud music that I vaguely recognized as U2.
We're having a party at the pool. Come on over. I'll call back on Monday, said a male voice. Bye-bye for now.
The line went dead. I redialed and said, Lieutenant Conover, please. It's an emergency. This is Detective Alex Cross. It's about Inspector Jamila Hughes of the San Francisco PD.
Oh, shit, I heard.
Then,
this is Conover. Who is this again?
I explained who I was and my involvement in the case in as few words as possible. I had the feeling that Conover was drunk, or close to it. It was his day off, but Jesus, it wasn't even 2 in the afternoon his time.
She went up in the hills looking for new wave vampires, he said, and laughed derisively. There are no vampires in Santa Cruz, Detective. Trust me on that. I'm sure she's just fine. She probably headed back to San Francisco.
There have been at least 2 dozen vampire-style murders so far. I tried to sober Conover up, at least to get through to him. They hang their victims and then drain the blood.
I told you what I know, Detective, he said. I guess I could call out some patrol cars, he added.
You do that. And while you do, I'm going to call the FBI. They believe in vampire murders. When was the last time you saw Inspector Hughes? He hesitated.
Who knows? Let me see. Must be close to 24 hours.
I hung up on Conover. I didn't like him at all. Then I sat and thought about everything that had happened since I'd first met Jamila Hughes. The case made my head spin. Everything about it was over the edge, completely new territory. Having the mastermind around made it even worse. I phoned Kyle Craig and then American Airlines. I called Tim Bradley back and told him I was on my way to California. Santa Cruz, the vampire capital. Jamila was in trouble out there. I could feel it in my blood.
Chapter 84.
On the long flight out of California, I realized I hadn't been tormented by the mastermind in 2 days. That was unusual, and I wondered if he was traveling too. Que pasa, mastermind? Maybe he was on the plane to San Francisco with me. I remembered a tired old joke about paranoia. A man tells his psychiatrist that everybody hates him.
The psychiatrist says he's being ridiculous. Everybody hasn't met him yet. It got worse. At one point, I actually took a walk down the aisle and checked out the other passengers. No one looked even vaguely familiar. No mastermind on board. No one seemed to be wearing fangs either. I was losing it. I arrived at San Francisco International Airport and was met by agents from the FBI. They told me that Kyle was on his way here from New Orleans. Lately, Kyle had been pressuring me more than ever about making the switch to the FBI. The change certainly made financial sense. Agents earned a lot more than detectives. The hours were usually better, too. Maybe I would talk to Nana and the kids after this was over. Hopefully soon, but why should I think that? I left the airport with three agents in a dark blue off-road vehicle. I sat in back with a senior agent from San Francisco. His name was Robert Hatfield, and he told me some of what they had so far. We found where some of the so-called vampires are staying. It's a ranch in the foothills north of Santa Cruz, not too far from the ocean. At this juncture, we don't know if Inspector Hughes is being held there. She hasn't been spotted.
What's out there in the hills? I asked Hatfield.
He was young-looking. Could have been anywhere between 35 and 50. He looked fit. A short brush cut. Appearances obviously meant a lot to him. Not a hell of a lot. It's rural. A couple of fairly large ranches. Rocks. Desert birds of prey. A few mountain cats. Not tigers? I asked.
Funny you should mention tigers. The ranch out there used to be a preserve for wild animals. Bears, wolves, tigers. Even an elephant or two. The owners trained animals, mostly for use in feature films and commercials. They were basically hippies left over from the 60s. The ranch was actually licensed by the Department of the Interior. It did business with Tippi Hedren, Siegfried and Roy.
The animals aren't still on the property?
Not for the past 4 or 5 years. The original owner disappeared. No one's been interested in buying the land. It's about 55 acres. Not good for much. You'll see.
What about the animals that had been there? You know what happened to them?
Some were bought by other preserves that supply specialty animals to movies. Bridget Bardot supposedly took some. So did the San Diego Zoo.
I sat back in my seat and thought everything through while we rode. I didn't want to get my hopes up again. I wondered if the past owners of the ranch might have left a tiger behind. I spun a wild scenario out a little in my head. Actually, it was kind of interesting. Vampires in Africa and Asia supposedly change shape into tigers rather than bats. The tiger imagery was certainly scarier than bats, and so were the ravaged bodies I'd seen. Also, Santa Cruz had a reputation to uphold. The vampire capital. We passed a farmhouse along the highway, and then a small winery. Not much else to see, though. Agent Hatfield told me that in summer the hills got very brown and gold, much like the African veldt. I've been trying not to think about Jamila and the danger she might be in. Why did she have to come up here alone? What drove her? The same things that drove me? If she was dead, I would never forgive myself. The car finally pulled off the main road. I didn't see a house or other building in any direction that I looked. Just barren hills. A hawk floated easily in liquid blue skies. The scene was quiet and serene, and quite beautiful. We turned down an unpaved road and went for about a mile over bumpy, very rocky terrain. We passed over the grill of a cow catcher. A broken split rail fence ran alongside the road for about 100 yards, stopped, then started again. Suddenly, we came upon 6 vehicles parked on either side of the trail. All were unmarked, mostly Jeeps. Standing right there was Kyle Craig. Kyle had his hands on his hips, and he was smiling as if he had the most amazing secret to tell me. I suspected that he did.
Chapter 85.
I think this is exactly what we've been working for, Kyle said as I walked up to him. We shook hands, an old ritual that reflected Kyle's formality. He looked calmer and more in control than he had during the past week.
Let me show you something, he said. Come.
I followed Kyle down along the split rail fence until we came to a broken down gate. He showed me a faded image. The body and head of a tiger had been branded into the gate. It was subtle, but this was it. It had to be. We had arrived at the tiger's lair. The group inside seems to be led by the sire. The new and improved one, I assume. We haven't been able to establish an identity for the leader.
Alex, the past sire, was the magician Daniel Erickson. Two members of the group just returned from a trip. They were in New Orleans. Pieces are finally starting to fit. I looked at Kyle, shook my head. How did you find all of this out? When did you get here, Kyle? How much have you been keeping from me? And why? Santa Cruz police contacted us and I came right out. They grabbed one of the undead when the little prick left the ranch. He's a local high school dropout. Wasn't as committed as some of the others. He told us what he knew. Is the sire in there now? Supposedly. This kid had never actually seen the sire. He's not part of the inner circle. The two members who traveled to New Orleans are in there, though. He heard they were the ones who killed Daniel and Charles. He said the two of them are total psychos. Well, I believe that. I looked down through the limbs of pine and cypress trees at the ranch. What about Jamila Hughes? His eyes shifted. We found her car in town, Alex, but no sign of her. The kid we questioned didn't know about her either. He claimed there was a commotion at the ranch late last night. He was bunked in with some of the younger ghouls. They thought that someone had broken the perimeter, thought it might be the police. But then it got quiet again, according to the boy. There's no evidence that she's there. Can I talk to him, Kyle? Kyle looked away. He didn't seem to want to answer me. The Santa Cruz police took him away. I guess you could go into town and see him. I talked to him, Alex. The androgynous little twerp was scared of me. Imagine that. Kyle was acting strange. But I reminded myself that he understood the deranged criminal mind better than any other FBI agent or police officer I had worked with. The agents who worked under him were convinced that he would run the bureau one day. I wondered if Kyle could ever take himself out of the field, though. I know you're worried about Inspector Hughes. I guess we could go in there right now, but I think we should wait. I want to go at them after midnight, Alex, or possibly near sunup. We're not even sure she's down there. Kyle paused. His eyes shifted toward the distant ranch house. I want to find out if they hunt as a group. There are questions we need answered. What motivates these freaks? What makes them tick? I want to make sure we get the sire this time.
Chapter 86. It was a long, cool, very tense night in the foothills outside Santa Cruz. I couldn't wait for it to be over, or maybe I couldn't wait for it to start. We learned something interesting right away. The woman lawyer who had been murdered in Mill Valley had been involved in a lawsuit trying to get control of this property. It was probably why she and her husband had been hung. I watched the ranch through binoculars from the surrounding trees and rock formations. I watched until my eyes ached. No one had left as of 11. I didn't see anyone standing lookout either. The people inside were either crazy or supremely confident. Or maybe they were innocent. Maybe this was another wrong turn for us. I was trying not to worry too much about Jamila, but it wasn't working. I couldn't bear to think that she might already be dead. Was that what Kyle thought? Was it what he knew and was keeping from me? At midnight, two males walked outside leading a tiger. I watched them through the night sight glasses. I was almost certain I had seen them in New Orleans. They'd been at the fetish ball, hadn't they? They loped off into the flat, open fields behind the house. One of the men got down on all fours, then rolled around in the tall grass with the cat. They were playing, weren't they? Jesus Christ. How incredibly weird. I remember that the tiger had been called off its prey in Golden Gate Park. About 20 minutes later, the men brought the cat to a pen behind the main compound. They hugged the 600-pound tiger as if it were a large dog. The lights in the main building and the nearby bunkhouse burned brightly until past 2. Loud rock and roll played. Then the lights were dimmed. No one had left the house to hunt. We still didn't know if Jamila was inside, or even if she was alive. I stayed awake and watched. I couldn't sleep, not even for an hour or so. The FBI continued to collect information on the people inside the domain. What in God's name were they doing down there? There was no word on the identity of the sire. We did learn about the two blonde males with the ponytails. William and Michael Alexander were the sons of a post-hippie couple who had worked at the ranch as animal handlers. The mother had been a zoologist. The boys had grown up comfortable around wild animals. They attended schools in Santa Cruz until they were 9 and 12, at which time the boys began to be homeschooled. They wore Moroccan robes and were always barefoot on their occasional trips to town.
They were considered bright, but odd and extremely secretive. The boys had gotten into trouble in their early teens and had been sent off to a state correctional facility for aggravated assault. They had been dealing drugs and also been caught breaking and entering. Kyle joined me in the rocks overlooking the ranch at around 3. "You look kind of green around the gills," I said to him. "Thanks. Long night. Long month." "You're worried about her, aren't you?" he asked me. He seemed like a detached observer now, calm and cool. It was pure Kyle. Calculated intelligence. "I don't know anything more, Alex. I've told you what I know."
"I can still see the body of Betsy Cavalier. I don't want to see something like that again."
"Yes, I'm worried about her. Aren't you? What are you feeling, Kyle? If she's alive down there, they have no reason to murder her now. They're keeping her there for a reason. If she's alive." Kyle patted my shoulder. "Get some sleep if you can," he said. "Rest up." Then he wandered off. But when I looked his way, he was watching me. I leaned against an oak tree and covered myself with my sport coat. I must have fallen asleep at some point between 3 and 3:30.
"I saw Betsy Cavalier in my dream.
Then my partner and friend Patsy Hampton, who had also been killed. Finally, I saw Jamila. Oh, Christ, not Jam. I couldn't stand that." I was aware of someone nearby, standing right over me. I opened my eyes. It was Kyle. "Time to go in," he said. "Time to get some answers."
Chapter 87. The ranch was 400 to 500 yards away. The terrain between the house and us was too open for us to sneak up on the complex. Was this where Jamila had been murdered? Kyle whispered,
"She might still be alive."
It was as if he were reading my thoughts. What else did he know? What was he hiding from me? "I've been thinking about the brothers," I said. "They never had to be careful before, so they weren't. The magicians were the careful ones. They committed murders for 12 years, never got caught. There's no record that they were even suspected of any of the murders."
"You think the new sires set up Daniel and Charles?"
"That's part of it, I'll bet. The brothers committed murders in towns where the magicians toured. The sire wanted us to catch up with Daniel and Charles. It was a trap."
"Why kill them in New Orleans?"
"Maybe because the brothers are psychopaths. Maybe they had orders to do what they did. We'll have to ask the sire.
They don't think anyone can stop them."
"Well, they're wrong about that," Kyle said. "They're going to be stopped." Which was when we got a surprise. The front door of the ranch house opened. Several men in dark clothes emerged. The two brothers weren't among them. The men hurried to a grassy area where pickup trucks and vans were parked in a ragged line. They started the vehicles, then drove them toward the front of the house. Kyle was on his handy talkie. He alerted the snipers waiting in the trees and rocks behind us. "Stand ready. Kyle, don't forget Jamila." He didn't answer me. The front door opened again. Shadowy figures began to move out of the house. They were clothed in hooded black gowns and they came in pairs. One person in each pair held a handgun to the head of the other.
"Oh, shit," I whispered. "They know we're here."
There was no way to tell who anybody was, or if any of the robed figures were actually hostages. I tried to pick out Jamila's shape, her walk. Was she among them? Was she alive? My heart felt heavy in my chest. I couldn't spot her from way up here.
"Everybody move, now," Kyle spoke into his radio. "Go, go!"
The black-robed figures continued to move toward the waiting trucks and vans. One of the hostages suddenly dropped to the ground. Only one.
"That's her," I called out. "Take out the one over her," Kyle ordered. A shot rang out from one of the snipers. A hooded figure slumped over in a heap. We charged forward, running down the steep hill toward the ranch. Some of the hooded figures fired shots at us. No one was hit. The FBI agents didn't return fire yet. Then gunfire rang out from the hills. Some of the robed figures dropped to the ground, dead or wounded. A few put their hands above their heads in surrender. I kept my eyes fixed on the robed figure I thought was Jamila. She had stood up again, but was stumbling, almost falling. Then the hood was pulled back, and I could tell it was Jamila. She looked up into the hills. She put her hands up high. I started to sprint. I was looking for the brothers and the sire. I moved toward Jamila. She was massaging her wrist. She was also shivering, and I gave her my jacket. "You okay?"
"Not sure.
They hung me from a beam, Alex. What an unbelievable scene. You can't imagine. I thought I was dead.
There were tears in her eyes. Where's the sire? I asked.
Maybe still inside. I think there's another way out of there.
Stay right here. I'll take a look. She shook her head.
No, not on your life. This is payback. I'm coming with you.
Chapter 88. Jamila and I searched the main ranch house. Then we checked a large, unattached bunkhouse. We didn't find anyone there. Not a straggler, not William or Michael Alexander, and not the mysterious sire. Jamila was still shivering some, but she refused to turn back.
You sure the brothers weren't out front with the others? She asked. Two blondes? Ponytails?
If they are, Kyle has them by now. I don't think so. Let's check the smaller shack. You know what's in there? She shook her head.
I didn't get the grand tour when I arrived, just straight to the dungeon. Then they left me hanging, so to speak.
I threw open the door of the shack and saw heaters and a water pump. The room smelled strongly of urine. A mouse scooted into a hole in the wall. I winced and shook my head at what I saw next. Two bodies lay sprawled and spread-eagled against the far wall. They were teenagers. Males. Both were naked, except for a few face and chest rings. I bent over them and took a closer look. Looked like street kids to me. The blood's been drained from the bodies. There were bite marks. Not just on the necks, but on the faces and limbs. The skin of both was as pale as alabaster. I looked away from the clouded eyes that stared up at me. There was nothing we could do for them now. I noticed a reddish-brown hatch cover among the dusty machines that provided water, heat, and probably air conditioning to the ranch. I moved across the room, bent down low to get a better look. The cover was loose, so I was able to pull it off. Darkness. Silence. What else was down there? Who else? I looked at Jamila, then I shone a flashlight into the hole. The hole was wide enough for someone to get down inside. I saw metal stairs. A tunnel. Then I saw footprints in the dirt below. Several pairs.
Go tell Kyle.
I turned to Jamila.
Get some help.
Jamila was already heading out the door. She started to run. I stared down into the abyss and wondered if anybody was looking back at me.